Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So who should be more afraid of yesterday's primary election results? Mainstream Democrats or mainstream Republicans? The more liberal Democrat, Joe Sestak, defeated Arlen Specter in Pennsylvania, as you no doubt know by now. The Tea Party conservative Rand Paul defeated Trey Grayson in Kentucky. And very importantly, Democrats held on to John Murtha's House seat in a hard-fought race in Pennsylvania that Republicans were hoping would be a bellwether. We'll get takes on the meanings of these elections from three guests today, including former Republican Senator Fred Thompson and Obama biographer Jonathan Alter. And we have a survey on our page. Which of yesterday's elections do you think was the most significant? Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehr Show to answer the question. Which of yesterday's elections do you think was the most significant? Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehr Show. I think I just tipped my hand for my own reaction to that question. And our first guest is Dahlia Lithwick, senior writer and legal affairs correspondent for Slate Magazine. She's been covering the Elena Kagan nomination with articles like one called The Sphinx, Why the Inscrutable Elena Kagan Makes Everyone Nervous. Hi, Dahlia. Welcome back to WNYC. Do you write your own headlines?
I do write my own headlines.
And you wrote The Sphinx 9 days ago. Because, you know, a lot of times reporters will come on and the article is really nuanced and delicate, but the headline is screaming. And I ask, God, you wrote this article called, you know, Such and Such is a Pig. And they say, well, I wrote the article, but some headline writer wrote the headline. But you wrote The Sphinx 9 days ago. And since then, a lot has been unearthed about Elena Kagan's record. Is she any less of a cipher to you today?
I think one of the things that's really fascinating about this particular nomination is the more we know, the more we don't know. And now I have not gone through all 140,000 pages of documents that were dumped yesterday. So maybe things will come clearer over the day as we read. But I do think that Elena Kagan has, and you know, this is brilliantly gaming the Supreme Court confirmation system, has really made it very, very difficult to know who she really is and what she really believes. And so really interestingly, on most of these hot button questions, the more information we get, the more you can say, well, she just took a position because she was working for Bill Clinton, or she took the position because she was Solicitor General, or she took this position at representing herself as the Dean of Harvard. It becomes, in a sense, easier and easier to say these aren't really her views, but there's very little that you can distill from what we do know that tells us this is something deep in her heart that Elena Kagan holds dear.
The Times had an article her views on campaign finance reform the other day. And as you know, as Solicitor General, she argued against the landmark Citizens United Supreme Court ruling that corporations could spend unlimited amounts to support their chosen candidates for office. But looking at her record, the Times concluded her history put her in general more in the camp of Antonin Scalia, who they mentioned by name, when it comes to government regulation of campaign speech. He's written of being skeptical that government has a role to play in equalizing speech. Do you have a conclusion about how Kagan would have ruled on Citizens United, such an important case?
No, in fact, the two principal pieces of data that everybody's poring over, and I should add, the free speech people and the election people are going insane interpreting the same data in very radically different ways. So it's, I think, quite an open question. But I think the two critical things are, one, that she, as Solicitor General, arguing the Citizens United case last fall, abandoned one of the three rationales that the government had been using to support campaign finance regulation. And this is the so-called distortion rationale, right, that pouring millions of dollars into corporate speech can distort the conversation, the national discussion of political issues. And she jettisoned that argument, and she jettisoned it quite obviously, and the Chief Justice made a lot of hay with that. So that's one thing. And then the other thing was this Law Review article she wrote in 1996, again signaling that she was quite critical of the big Supreme Court decision, Austin, in 1990 case that really espoused the distortion rationale. So she starts to look more like a speech purist, like someone like Kathleen Sullivan, former dean of Stanford Law School, who is on the speech side of Citizens United and says this is, in fact, an unconstitutional regulation of free speech. So that data is quite equivocal. One was a Law Review article that I should add is very, very thinky, very, very big picture and technical. And the other is the position she took as Solicitor General. But I think that if you look at those things, it's not wrong to say she may have really intellectually distanced herself from the John Paul Stevens position that he articulated so ferociously in his dissent in Citizens United.
Leaving the possibility open that President Obama will actually be moving the court to the right by replacing Stevens with Kagan.
Well, I think that this is one of the issues in which people are quite concerned that if you read the tea leaves, and again, who knows what the tea leaves say, but if you read them the way certainly it looks like she is not in John Paul Stevens' camp on Citizens United. I would add, though, that because Obama has gone out of his way, and I know we've talked about this, Brian, he has made her the losing face of Citizens United. When he criticized the court, he said, you know, he expressly used this distortion rationale, talked about drowning out the voices of the little guy with big corporate money. When he tapped Kagan, he again talked about her as fighting for the little guy in a system. So he has deliberately kind of hung her on this idea that she is going to be a champion of exactly the thing that she may have distanced herself from. One has to believe that the Obama administration, in putting her face on the losing side of Citizens United, has vetted her enough to know what her views are on this case. I mean, it would be shocking if after over and over again he celebrates her as being a champion of the voices of the little guy over big corporate speech, she were to turn around on the court and not hold those views. So he must know something on this issue that we don't. Otherwise, I just can't imagine he would be fetting her as the John Paul Stevens model on Citizens United.
Dahlia Lithwick from Slate talking about the emerging record of Elena Kagan, the Supreme Court nominee, which I guess brings us to how to judge a Supreme Court nominee from her history as Solicitor General. I mean, the job is to represent the president before the Supreme Court and elsewhere, so she is representing a client, not herself. But does that necessarily make you dismiss everything she does in that role as not representative of her?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think you're quite right. It's a tough needle to thread. Certainly there are people who say that she made the choice to abandon one of those three arguments in Citizens United, and that has to mean something. But I think just generally one would say that, yes, Chief Justice John Roberts made this point at his own confirmation. Look, when I'm working for the government, I am making my best possible argument for my client, not for myself. This issue comes up again with Kagan when you look at her memos on abortion, which are getting a lot of scrutiny right now. What she's going to say at her hearings was, listen, I was working as a policy advisor in the Clinton administration that was policy advice to my client, the president. And you're right, it's very hard to disaggregate when that stops being Elena Kagan and starts being her profession. But I do think it's probably fair to say in all cases, her first and foremost responsibility is to her client, and those are the arguments she advances.
But presumably, the president of the United States, who could choose any lawyer in the world to be his Solicitor General, would choose someone who is very close to his own legal views, and especially a former constitutional law professor like Barack Obama, I would think.
I think that's right, and I think that one thing that sometimes gets downplayed here is how well he knows her, how long he's known her. You know, they go back to the faculty at Chicago Law School together. He knows, I think, very well what her constitutional views are, and I would even add to that, he knows her manner, he knows her style, not just her core constitutional beliefs, but he knows that she has qualities that he most appreciates in himself, this sort of centrist, the moderator of extreme views, a person able to reach across the aisle. So I think what he really values in her goes beyond just these core constitutional beliefs that, you know, there's a place for the judiciary but not an activist place. Those are Obama's views. But over and above that, I think he really does respect and highly regard the quality that she has of making everyone feel as though they've been heard and that she's trying to represent all views. I think that's not a constitutional worldview. It's kind of a political or strategic worldview. But I think with Obama, that's almost as critical as the core constitutional views themselves.
By the way, Dahlia, what is a Solicitor General? Why isn't the U.S. Attorney General the appointee who speaks for the President of the United States in court?
It's a good question. The Solicitor General has always been known as the 10th Justice, that they represent the president's view at the court, and that it's an advocacy job. It's not just a legal job. You're sort of the lawyer for the president's views, and the Solicitor General just traditionally is someone who is a tremendous advocate. I mean, those are the skills. If you think back to Ted Olson or Paul Clement or Seth Waxman. This isn't just, you know, somebody who represents all of the president's political views. This is somebody who advocates the president's legal positions in court. And one of the things that was so interesting in Kagan was that she had never done an oral argument in her life. She's only done six now, having started in September, of the very tough job of having to argue Citizens United as her first time out. And one of the things that you're hearing a lot about now is that she wasn't necessarily the strongest advocate. She had big, big shoes to fill following Ted Olson and Paul Clement, and that she wasn't a tremendous advocate. What she was in that role was two things, again, that I think are real clues into Obama's view of what he wants in an SG. One, she wasn't a fantastic advocate, although she was a phenomenal, apparently, manager of that office. And everybody raves about how she did as a manager of the SG's office. The other thing is, again, she was deeply respectful of opposing views on the court. If you read the transcripts of her oral argument, she doesn't come in there as a bomb thrower and say, here's what the president wants and this is what I'm advocating. She's always more nuanced, always more subtle. So the very different SG that she modeled for us. But I think it gives you enormous clues into why Obama has such high regard for her. He really prizes that ability to thread the needle, to say, you know what, Justice Scalia, you're right on that.
We have just a few minutes left with Dahlia Lithwick from Slate talking about Elena Kagan. As you can hear, Dahlia covers the Supreme Court and legal affairs in general in great detail. And I don't know if you want to move into the realm of political analyst at all here, but President Obama, just to tie this to today's headlines, he endorsed Arlen Specter against Joe Sestak, and he nominated Elena Kagan rather than a more identifiably full-throated liberal. Do you think those two things are somehow representative of an Obama pattern?
Yeah, I think that Obama, I wrote a little bit about this at the end of last week, Brian. I think that Obama has absolutely abandoned the notion that he is going to put liberal Scalias on the court. He has abandoned the notion that the best thing for the Supreme Court to balance the Roberts, Alito, Thomas, Scalia, strong, unified right wing of the court is to create an equally strong, unified left wing team of bomb throwers. I think what he has always said, and we didn't believe him, but I think now we can start to believe him, is that those are not values he really prizes at the court, and that it's not even clear that he thinks that the court should have the role that it's had in this country for the past decades. He really feels, I think, that the best thing he can do for the court is put a moderate on, put someone on who will bring down the temperature a few degrees, but not somebody who's a left-wing ideologue to match Scalia point for point, but somebody to try to maybe bring civility back to the court, a little bit of moderation and centrism back to the court. So I think that, you know, for those of us who've watched the effect of George W. Bush's impact on the court, right? He seated a third of the federal judiciary, and these are young people, and they're very conservative. They're called, kind of called movement conservatives. The people who expected Obama to respond point for point are now looking around and saying, whatever Obama does, however he views the judicial branch, it's much, much closer to this centrist view, the view that we're going to try to reshape the court, take it to the sidelines a little bit, take it out of the center of American life and move it back. And he's used the language of activism, I think, to great effect. He doesn't want an activist court. And it's really interesting to see that I think liberals are much more disappointed with the choice of Kagan than conservatives.
Dahlia Lithwick, legal affairs and correspondent and senior editor for Slate.com. Dahlia, great. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And don't forget, we have that survey up on our webpage. Which of the primaries yesterday do you think is most significant? Joe Sestak, Rand Paul, Blanche Lincoln, or the John Murtha House seat? And our next guest will be the only person ever to be both a star on Law and Order and a U.S. senator. I think you can probably figure out who that is, and we'll get his take on the primary next door. Stay with us.